You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll hear from a Tennessee folk group who used to live in Wisconsin and are returning this month for a number of concerts all around the state. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Sun Prairie is cleaning up after a natural gas explosion in the city's downtown led to one death, and the state is taking back money from the Mercer School District after a school board member brought allegedly wasteful spending to light. Rob Menser is with us again for a look at those stories and more. He's a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thank you.
Let's start in Sun Prairie. This tragic explosion caused one death. Cleanup still underway. Can you tell us what led up to this explosion?
Sure. This is a really sad story, and just the destruction of these several buildings in downtown Sun Prairie is just extremely dramatic. So this is a gas leak that caused this huge explosion there on Tuesday night, which then caused these fires that destroyed these big buildings across a couple of blocks. The explosion killed the firefighter Corey Barr, who owned a tavern downtown. That was one of the buildings that was destroyed. And there was another firefighter who was hospitalized in the blast. He was burned and his jaw broken. But he is apparently is doing better, or is in the hospital and is up and talking. So as far as we know, the cause of this was a subcontractor working for through Verizon Wireless that was doing work in the area that appears to have punctured the natural gas line. We don't know that much more than that. I guess there are no reports to suggest that this was an intentional act. But we don't know whether it was like negligent, whether it was just an accident, that something that happens. And of course, there's going to be a lot more investigation of what caused this.
As we're hearing in the news, Rob, flags flying at half-mast in Wisconsin in honor of the late Corey Barr. A memorial coming up tomorrow. Here's his wife, Abby Barr, talking about how people knew him.
The outpouring of the messages coming in about him and how wonderful he was is not just people saying it. It's true. It's 110% true. He'd give the shirt off his back. He's just amazing.
And evacuations had gotten underway before the explosion. So if there's one bit of good news, that those evacuations, it sounds like, Rob, could have prevented a lot worse happening.
Yeah, no, there's just no question. The police and the first responders who responded when the report of the gas leak was first made absolutely got people to safety, and it is without a doubt they save many lives.
Turning to another story this week, the state of Wisconsin trying to get back $175,000 from the Mercer School District after one of their school board members recently elected tried to highlight allegedly wasteful spending there. This story hasn't been as prominent in the news, Rob, but kind of a big deal. What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't been as prominent in the news, although this week the story reported out of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel was definitely one of the most prominent stories on our USA Today Network Wisconsin sites this week. So Mercer is this small town way up north in Iron County. It has fewer than 2,000 people in it. And this is the story of a woman who was a critic of the school board and decided to run for school board, was elected, and started like poking around and asking questions about how they conducted business. And she started to find these practices that are, you know, that she felt were hard to justify. There were other critics felt that way. The district was paying its administrator a higher salary than the terms of his contract. That's not a typical way for a school district to operate. There was something called a community recreation fund, which is normal. A lot of districts have these. It was under the current administrator, it had grown from $3,000 per year to more than $200,000 per year. So there ended up being this sort of escalating fight between school board members and this one particular school board member who was raising these criticisms. They tried to block her from seeing school board, district documents, and getting these, she had to file open records requests and so on. She ended up taking her complaints to the Department of Public Instruction. They asked for documentation from the district. District apparently could not provide it, or anyway hasn't provided it, and this led to this decision that the state is clawing back $175,000 in funding from the district.
And so what happens now? Can the school appeal this?
The school can appeal it, and it has said they will appeal it. Some of this has to do with documentation. It may be that they are able to make the case that the spending was proper. So we don't know that. The district administrator did not speak to for this particular report that came out. But what you see is this, it's like this story about a small town in a way, and this is something that happens in local government, which is somebody is maybe a gadfly or a critic, and then other people's reaction is to try to shut them down, and it leads to this vicious cycle that ends up making everyone. My argument is it ends up hurting everyone. The school board actually voted in this case to consider legal action against anyone who forwarded an email critical of the district. That is not a good policy, but it sort of shows you where people's minds are. And they said that there have been cases of reported cases of vandalism. These are just claims. We don't exactly know. But the point is that emotions have run high on this in this conflict, and it shows how these local issues get, they're close to people's hearts.
Briefly, before I move on to one more issue, this all started. This person had run for the school board after it came out that the girls' basketball team was shown 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah, they were allowed to watch 50 Shades of Grey on a field trip or something, which. Apparently this community member thought was inappropriate. I've not seen it, so I couldn't possibly speak to that.
Nor have I. Well, I want to jump to one more kind of fun story here, Rob. A woman from New Berlin is making headlines for maybe, Rob, changing the way we think about bowling shoes. What's going on?
Yeah, I always thought that that bowling shoes were supposed to be ugly, but but apparently maybe not. Kelly Dugan is a graphic designer from New Berlin, and she is a finalist in a national contest to build a better bowling shoe. You can see her design. It's sort of a nice, kind of nice blue. It has a interesting pattern on it. They're not bad shoes. They don't look like any bowling shoes I've seen.
And would you wear these, Rob, outside of the bowling alley if they became available on the market?
Well, let's not. I wouldn't go quite that far. You know what I mean? I have some standards to uphold. But for bowling shoes, they're quite nice.
So what do we know what's next for the finalists here? Will we be seeing these soon?
Yeah, so you're right. They're going to be there's going to be a big event in New York in August, early August, August 7th, I guess, at a Times Square location. And so they'll make a big show of it and declare the winner. So go Kelly Dugan, I say.
Rob, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, thank you.
Robert Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He joined us for a weekly look at news from around the state. The country folk duo Count This Penny, our husband and wife team, Alan and Amanda Rigel. The Tennessee natives relocated to Wisconsin for a number of years and gained a loyal following among local music fans who fell in love with their dark, elegant ballads and intricate harmonies. In 2015, they moved back to Tennessee, where they recorded a second full-length album titled A Losing Match. This month, they're back in Wisconsin for a string of performances, and we caught up with them earlier today in our studio.
There's a half-hearted look in your eyes. You stumbled on loneliness. I've tried, but I don't know why.
Alan, Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Well, take us back a little bit. How long were you living here with us in Wisconsin?
5 years.
Five years.
And now, do you miss it a little bit, being back here? Fond memories?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. I miss all of it. I miss the seasons. I miss the people. I miss the scene that we were a part of when we were up here. I miss the energy and the level of activity. I miss it. Yeah, absolutely, I miss it.
Amanda, what took you back to Tennessee?
Day jobs. I mean, also, our family is there. we both have huge extended families, and they all live, for the most part, they all live really, really close to us. You know, my little brother lives about 10 minutes away. Alan's sister lives about 25 minutes from us, so that's been really wonderful to be able to get back and, like, go to our nephew's baseball games and soccer games and stuff. That's pretty fun.
Well, now here you are back in Wisconsin with your new album, A Losing Match. Your vocal harmonies are on full display in songs like Baby You. Let's give a little listen.
Well, I guess.
Sound really natural, and we've seen that when you performed here a few years back, singing together. So what is it, if I was sitting around the dinner table with you two, are you just kind of like, you know, harmonizing on your own at home?
Well, for a while, we were mostly just singing the Hamilton soundtrack constantly. That's probably the closest we've ever come to constant singing. That happened for about six months straight, though.
It was a long 6 months.
It was a long, yeah. We got really heavily involved with Hamilton.
No, our singing, interestingly enough, sort of waxes and wanes, and so we'll go for periods of time where we really are singing a lot together and finding great joy in that, and then we forget. And then we get wrapped up in our sort of our day-to-day, and we kind of lose touch with it, and then there's this great moment where we start to sing together again, and we're like, oh man, this is pretty rad. Yeah. We have a good time doing this.
And when you're creating on your own or in the studio and songwriting, does the harmony just kind of come naturally between the two of you, or are you like, let's try it this way, let's try it this way, and you have to really work at finding the right match?
The answer is yes and no, which is that Amanda, typically when she starts to sing harmony, it just shows up. There's something in her brain that allows her to do that, and I'm the exact opposite. It feels a little bit more like a math equation where I'm trying to sort of piece it together and try to find a line that makes sense, and we'll go through one bar at a time trying to figure out the part. So it, yes and no is the answer, I think.
Is this something that you kind of always had, Amanda, or you trained into it? Where did your ear for harmony and just finding that right harmony come from?
Well, I had a boyfriend in high school who, Alan and I were both in band together. We've known each other since we were 15. And we both played trumpet in band, and I was really heavily into playing the trumpet. You know, I was like a seventh grader listening to old Louis Armstrong records.
Nice.
Just like, this is blowing my mind. And then I developed this crush on this other boy, and he said to me, I play the guitar. And I said, I've always wanted to know how to play the guitar, which was a complete lie. I never had any interest in learning to play the guitar. And so then it was just, you know, sort of having a friendship with him that introduced me to the idea of even singing harmony. And so just kind of like listening to the radio, I would try to do it. Then I like, now, you know, living with Alan and playing music with him, I see him really listen carefully and keep working at a harmony. And so his wind up being way more fascinating to me because he'll chip away at it until it's slightly weird and better, you know. So that's fun to watch. I'm too lazy to do that, but it's really remarkable.
I want to get into instrumentation a little bit. There's some more, from what I've listened to, a little more piano on this album that I remember on from previous albums to the last time you were on. Here's a little bit of that.
You said I was tough.
So did it just feel right, Amanda, to have this one with piano, or were you making a conscious, the two of you conscious attempt to broaden out the instrumentation a little bit?
I can't really remember. You know, I think I remember one time talking to my brother about some of this stuff, and he's kind of a straight shooter with his opinions, you know, and he was like, I just think it'd be cool if you guys had a song that didn't start out with acoustic guitar. And I think that informed me a little bit, but also what really happened is our friend Josh Oliver was available when we were making this record, and he's just a brilliant piano player, and he plays all the lead guitar parts on the record and some organ and stuff. So it was partially my little brother's opinionated self, and partially the genius of Josh Oliver being in the room.
Absolutely.
In the studio having a piano.
Yes.
That's always crucial.
That's a key.
It really was.
The piano.
A beautiful old upright piano, yeah.
Some of my favorite parts of the record are actually some of those creaks and the pedals that you can hear from that old piano.
Yeah.
So we've known Josh for a long time, and when it worked out that he had the time to play and was excited about the project, we did start to make some decisions so that we could showcase some of his musicianship.
I want to check out some more songs to get a taste of the range here. A cover on this one in a full band number, Tennessee Waltz.
Yes, I lost my love in Dorland the night they were playing the beautiful Tennessee.
This is a song that's been recorded a time or two and performed by marching bands, I understand. And what is it like to go in and tackle this song that, where you are, everybody knows? Is there just like a legal requirement that at some point, as a Tennessee musician, you have to do this song?
Yeah, to move back to Tennessee, that was our price of admission. Must record Tennessee Waltz.
Mm-hmm.
We were listening to Redheaded Stranger a bunch.
Willie Nelson.
Mm-hmm.
And he recorded Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain, and it was a bit of a critical piece of that record was the fact that he chose to record this song that had been recorded a bunch. And so we kind of...
Is that the one?
Isn't it?
Well, I can't remember. But there's a traditional on there, and we were kind of like, oh, we should do
that. So we tried to just sort of steal that. And, uh-huh. and the record kind of follows a narrative, and there's a moving piece in Tennessee Waltz where I think it's a really sad song, right? You know, I lost my love and darling. And so the song itself helps to move a narrative, and so we thought that it might fit really nicely in the context of the album.
What is that narrative, Amanda?
The narrative is sort of like a relationship reconciliation story, I guess. Like, you know, sort of like recognizing imperfections and sort of like rallying after a tough stretch of life. I don't know. I feel like we wrote this up like for a press release, and that's not what it says at all.
No, but no. The narrative is evolving.
Yeah, the narrative is evolving.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to get too personal, but you're a couple. You've just done this album on relationship reconciliations. Is this coming from life stories here? Your own life stories?
You know, they say, I think the best thing I've ever heard is fiction is telling the truth about other people. So it's a combination of like our own experiences and friends' experiences and just, you know, life in general.
And we were in transition in lots of parts of our life at that time when we recorded the album. And so this is absolutely the darkest album that we have recorded. And it just is sort of relentless in that. And I think that there are parts of our own lives that, trickled into that. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I want to give a listen to one more song that jumped out to us, Horses. Now, you performed this one for us on Setlist a few years ago and played that. And it was a different version on the album. And we've got a little, I think, montage of the two.
Horses come in pairs against the reins.
Oh.
Hear the horses come in pairs against the reins. And the horses come in pairs. The horses come in pairs against the rain.
All right, so So for the people listening at home, there was a shocked, audible reaction in the studio. Like,
oh my gosh, and,
like we did it at that sort of double time tempo.
Yeah.
I don't even remember that. It's the look on your face is there.
That is accurate.
That
I have no recollection of it.
What a nice treat. Thank you.
Yeah, that's
that was
bonkers.
So cool.
So you didn't remember doing it that way?
No.
No.
I don't think
that was you. It wasn't some imposters doing your song
for
us.
No, I think that was you guys. Yeah, that definitely wasn't us.
That was a cover. That's
somebody else.
Yeah. Well, but songs grow and evolve over time for you.
Clearly. Oh, that one did. I've struggled with this song for a couple of years.
You're still struggling with it.
I really am still struggling with it. I ask not to perform it most times we are performing because I still struggle with it.
Really?
Yeah, and I think it's a good song. I think some of the lyrics in it are really poignant, but for some reason the tune is still changing and still growing legs, or is just what it is now. That's part of, I guess, the process of recording is you just kind of, you got to hit the pause button on that at some point in time, and that's what happened with this song. I do like the newer version.
That's like Mike Zirkle told us when we made our record here in Madison. He said, no record is ever finished. You just have to eventually let go of it. That's why it's called a release, which I thought was really, really
great.
Poetic. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if people go to your shows, they should definitely request Horses.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah. The double time version of Horses. Yeah. That's
secret,
crazy.
The basement tapes. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So as we wrap up, what's it like being back in the music scene in Wisconsin, reconnecting with old friends here?
Yeah, we saw so many people last night. We played at Mineral Point Opera House, and we saw a lot of familiar faces, and that was really, really wonderful. It was a great welcome home. Actually, I think as soon as we got on stage, somebody was like, welcome back to Wisconsin, from the audience, and it just felt so great.
And we're on the road with Simon Balto right now, which is an old friend of ours who's a fantastic singer-songwriter that we met here in Madison. So it does feel like reconnecting. It was really fantastic.
Well, welcome back to Wisconsin, and thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for having us.
I know y'all love.
That was Amanda and Alan Rigel of the country folk duo Count This Penny. You can catch them playing around Wisconsin over the next several weeks, including shows tonight and tomorrow at Three Brothers Farm in Oconomowoc. Coming up, we'll talk about politics and immigration in the United States as part of our week-long immigration series. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Loving arms of the Lord. Just look at shake hands with the man. I fell in love with. No, you can't tell me from a dove. The loving arms of the Lord.
Now we've been examining various issues within the immigration debate in the United States. It's a hot button topic, one that's been invoked for decades on the political stage. The politics of immigration isn't a new issue, but the polarization reached a critical point during the 2016 presidential election when now President Donald Trump ran on a zero-tolerance platform towards undocumented immigrants and on building a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. Our next guest is here to talk about the politics of immigration, the impact politics has on immigration policy, and the people who get caught in partisan fighting. Shobha Sivaprasad Wadia is a professor of law at Penn State University and an expert in immigration law. She's also founder and director of the Center for Immigrants' Rights Clinic. Shobha, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be back.
Well, why do you think, you've worked on the law side of this a lot, why do you think immigration has risen again and again as such a contentious political issue in the United States?
As you alluded to, immigration has long been controversial. There have been many attempts to pass legislation that would reform our immigration laws. And I think one reason it has derailed is there has been a belief by some politicians that having divisive language or working towards problems as opposed to solutions would lead to success. And I think ultimately we have to talk about solutions. And eventually the politicians who do talk about solutions to our immigration system will be the ones who are rewarded.
When did you see immigration in its most recent kind of polarized manner rise as such a polarizing issue in the United States? It's, as you say, it's been up and down. When did you see in the more recent years this coming back as a hot issue?
Sure. So I've been in the immigration space for about 20 years, and have seen the controversy through many different lenses as a practicing attorney before the old agency, Immigration and Naturalization Service, as a policy advocate during three cycles of comprehensive immigration reform during the George W. Bush administration, and now as a law teacher and researcher during the Obama and now Trump administrations. And I think one genesis for the controversy is that immigration law is complicated. The statute was passed by Congress in 1952. It has been compared second in complication to the U.S. tax code. And so in some ways, using sound bites becomes easier than talking about actual solutions. But we know what the solutions are. There have been bipartisan immigration solutions on the table in years past. And the question now is, do we have enough politicians who are willing to attach their names to those solutions and push it to the finish line?
Yeah, what is it that is standing in the way of that and has been standing in the way of that?
Well, as I alluded earlier, some might be connected to the idea that it's hopeless, right? That there are no solutions. And I think some of the rhetoric we hear adds to that feeling of hopelessness. The narrative that has been used in this administration towards immigrants and the divisive language that has been used between who is American and other has been so striking. And so I think those are some of the causes for why immigration has been divided and why a solution has been looked like it's further away than it actually is.
Shobha Sivaprasad-Wadia is with us from Penn State University, looking at politics and immigration here in the United States. You mentioned the Trump campaign and presidency. Let's give a listen to then-candidate Donald Trump when he announced his candidacy back in 2015. A lot of talk about immigration. Here's some of that.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people. But I speak to border guards, and they tell us what we're getting.
And some people at that moment even thought that rhetoric was going to hurt his candidacy. He is the president now. There's enough political support for that attitude toward immigration to win a Republican primary and not prevent a win in the general election.
So it's a great example of how divisive language is at the opposite end of the spectrum to finding solutions. I think ultimately we have to talk about what is good for America and also use unifying language. Leaving aside the misrepresentations that have pervaded both during the Trump presidency and before he took office, for years we had politicians who cared about solutions asking, for example, for a path to citizenship for people who are living in the United States without papers. We have upwards of 11 million people in the U.S. living without papers. More than half of that population has lived in the U.S. for over a decade. Many have U.S. citizen children. I think that family reunification and a pathway to citizenship is something that Americans generally support, and we see that in poll after poll. Similarly, if we look at people who might be coming in the future to fill jobs that are in demand, a legislative solution would cover that. And then finally, making sure that there is fair enforcement, right? The best way to improve national security might be to find out who people in the United States without papers actually are and to allow them to step forward and apply or register for what is eventually a legalization policy.
Yeah, make the connection. How would that boost national security?
So if we were to look at the population today of 11-plus million people living without papers, I would say in this environment, the rhetoric is only causing a greater chilling effect for people to cooperate and step forward. Contrast that to a legislative solution that has incentives, maybe a fine or a fee, where an individual or family shared their name and information, were told that their information would not be used for enforcement purposes, were found to have a job or a family relationship, and then be able to get on a line. People often ask, why don't they just get online? But the reality is the current framework for our immigration law provides no line for the vast majority of people who are living in the U.S. without papers and contributing in meaningful ways.
You mentioned public opinion. I'm sorry. Go ahead. You weren't done.
I wanted to not lose sight of changes and reforms that we should also be making to legal immigration. So, for example, in 1990, Congress created statutory ceilings and quotas for how many visas would be allocated for certain family relationships, such as spouses, children, parents of U.S. citizens or spouses and children of green card holders. It drew similar lines for certain employer-employee relationships, such as a foreign national with extraordinary ability in the sciences working at NIH, sponsored by the institution to work and eventually get a green card. Well, these ceilings haven't changed in over two decades. And so that is what has caused backlogs for people who are in legally qualifying relationships. And what that means for the children of those who are waiting is that often they will not have an opportunity to eventually obtain a green card, though they are, again, in a legally qualifying relationship. So imagine if you were looking at a quota or, you know, any type of allotment. Maybe it's a club you belong to or a university that you gained admission to 20, 30 years ago. If those allotments never changed over three decades and were basically unresponsive to the marketplace, to demands, to needs, where would that leave us? Unfortunately, that's where our immigration statute is today, and we have a solution, and that solution is to increase those caps and have a more flexible cap for those seeking admission in the future.
Shobha Sivaprasad-Wadi is with us right now looking at the politics of immigration. She's a professor of law at Penn State University and an expert in immigration law, also the founder and director of the Center for Immigrants' Rights Clinic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you base your vote in part on immigration issues? And what do you want Congress and your congressional and Senate representatives to do? How do you want them to vote on immigration issues? What questions do you have about the role politics plays in the immigration debate and immigration enforcement? What would you like to see change, if anything, in the system? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation now about the role politics plays. Now we talk about immigration and how immigration laws are written and enforced. Shobha Sivaprasad-Wadi is with us, professor of law at Penn State University, expert in immigration law, and founder and director of the Center for Immigrants' Rights Clinic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is immigration a motivating issue for you in politics, in writing to your representatives, in voting for congressional and Senate representatives, for example? Do you think that Congress should come together and do some kind of serious, comprehensive immigration reform? What would you want that to look like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. John is with us in La Crosse. John, hi.
Hello there.
What do you think?
I guess what I think is that I think we keep posing the question wrong, and I think we keep referring to immigration incorrectly, because the general question is, are you opposed to immigration? And if you asked me, I would be against illegal immigration, but I am definitely for immigration. So there's two separate ideals here that are getting thrown into one, and I think that's what's causing a lot of turmoil in generalized conversation, making it almost politicized that you can only answer that you're against immigration, and it might be legal immigration. So if that makes any sense.
Gotcha, John. And I'll muddy the waters a little more, Shoba, adding in categories like asylum seekers and refugees. A lot of times when we're talking about people coming into the United States, there are a lot of categories here. Oh, and it looks like we've lost our guest, Shoba Siva Prasad Wadia, and hopefully we're trying to get her back. We are talking about the politics of immigration and looking for your input, too, at 800-642-1234. This is part of a week-long series, by the way, our fifth part of that. If you've missed any of it, you can always go back to our archives at WPR.org. That's WPR.org. Look for our immigration series there. We've covered a lot of immigration 101 type topics, a lot of the basics of how immigration law works that might be lost in a lot of the political conversations. Shoba, I think we have you back.
Yeah, sorry about that.
That's okay. Well, these mysterious things happen sometimes. Our caller had said it's tough to talk about immigration sometimes because, if someone's asked if they're opposed to immigration, well, they might be opposed to illegal immigration, he says, but all for legal immigration. And I threw in categories like asylum seekers and refugees. We're talking about a lot of different people in different situations.
That's a fair point. And I think when we talk about what the solution is in the realm of reform, it can be all of the above. You know, getting to the earlier comment I made about lines, right? As a law professor, I believe strongly in the rule of law and what the statute said and what parameters Congress has drawn. But if those parameters have not been revised or made room for all of the changes that we've seen in our society and all of the ways in which immigrants have otherwise integrated, that's when we get to the conversation or question about where the solution lies. I strongly believe that many, if not the majority of people living in the U.S. without papers would rather be on a legal line and on a pathway to citizenship. Interestingly, with asylum seekers, and they're not the only population, it's a good example to show that somebody without papers may anyway be eligible for relief or a benefit under our laws. And that might be a good way to talk about how status itself is constantly changing. So to the extent we try and draw lines between, for example, somebody who entered without inspection and somebody who holds a green card, the reality is that could be the very same person over time. It's possible that somebody could cross the border but eventually qualify for a waiver, fall in love, and acquire a green card.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Bill in Manitowoc. Bill, hi.
Yeah, hi. You know, I kind of support a middle ground on this. I'd like to, Trump was elected, and everybody knew what he stood for when he ran for president. So I do want to do something for the Dreamer kids. I think that they weren't to blame for being brought into this country. But at the same time, we absolutely have to secure that southern border, or we're going to have the same problem in 20 years. Reagan gave amnesty. And, 20 years later, we're talking about the same problem. I just, there's billions, and that's with a B, people living in poverty in the world. And if we let, they would all love to come here, and we would look like India or Bangladesh if we let all the refugees come in. So there's got to be a middle ground here.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Shoba, what do you think?
A fair point. A few points to make as a follow-up. Interestingly, the number of people who are arriving at our border and the number of apprehensions have been generally down in the last few years. We have seen a lot of money over the last several decades devoted to the border, and yet that hasn't impacted the flow if we look over 40 years. And so that really begs the question of what reform can or should look like. I would also point out that in a universe of limited resources, the government has roughly the funds to deport about 400,000 or less than 4% of the 11 plus million people living in the U.S. without papers. So Congress aside, the executive has choices to make about who to target for enforcement and who to place on the back burner. It sounds like the caller might place those who have DACA on the back burner. They seem to be people who are in the U.S., contributing to our educational and economic space, and have lived in the U.S. for over a decade. And so I would agree with the caller that we do have to set priorities. Unfortunately, we are in a landscape in this administration where many people are considered to be enforcement priorities, including those who have the types of qualities and roles that are very consistent with American values.
Thanks for that call. Go next to Mark with us in Juneau County. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you think?
You posed this question as being in favor of comprehensive immigration control. That I oppose, because you don't know you've got too many moving parts. You can't look to see what the result is of any part. Pass whatever you want to pass on a smaller basis, see what happens, make your adjustments, pass something else. If you did science the way they try to do comprehensive anythings, it would be a complete failure. It's you have to be able to measure what the effect is, and you cannot measure effect on something as big as comprehensive.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. And Mark, summing up a debate that's happened on and off in Congress, I think, Shoba, the question of do we try to do everything at once when it comes to immigration and border security, or a bit here, a bit there?
It's a really fair question where reasonable minds have different points of view. My own view is that we have to reach a point where we have a unified idea of what comprehensive is, even within the immigration advocate community. There have been lines drawn in different places. But I think that once that answer is made, and I think we have been there historically, that we should have a comprehensive immigration reform bill. And I think oversight and accountability will be incredibly important, as will the implementation of any comprehensive solution. Even after a bill or piece of legislation is passed by Congress, the implementation itself is carried out largely by federal agencies, and the care taken around that implementation will really matter.
We'll leave it there for now, Shoba. Thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Shoba Sivaprasad Wadia is a professor of law at Penn State University and an expert in immigration law. She's also the founder and director of the Center for Immigrants' Rights Clinic. She joins us today to talk about how the issue of immigration has become such a polarizing political topic today and offer some solutions to get out of the gridlock surrounding the issue. This was part of our week-long series examining immigration through law and history. You can check out this conversation and others in that series at WPR.org. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, we'll look at the dangers facing workers in the poultry industry. And soap operas were one of the earliest forms of television programming. We'll find out how they've evolved and the influence they've had on American culture. Plus, we'll look at the latest indictments in the Mueller probe that came down earlier today, all against the backdrop of the Trump-Putin meeting scheduled for Monday. That and more, all coming up Monday here on Central Time.